Hello, my beautiful Woman Inc. listeners. Welcome back. My guest this week is Silvana Ward-Durrett. Silvana is the co-founder and CEO of Masonette. Masonette was inspired late one night in 2016 when, like many founders, a moment of frustration led to invention. New mothers and best friends, Silvana and Louisiana hit a wall while trying to search and shop online for their children. Scores of tabs open on the computer, too many brands, too many sites. I know the feeling. I hate having tabs open. It's my pet peeve. They knew there must be a better way to help parents navigate, find, and choose the right products. This led to the birth of Masonette in 2017, an expertly curated marketplace that features the best children's products from around the globe for families of every kind. Together, they have grown Masonette to be a leading innovator and the fastest aggregator of the $630 billion children's market. As CEO, Silvana leads business strategy and operations for the company, which grew three times in 2020 and has raised $50 million in total funding to date. Silvana developed an eye for curation and honed in her operational experience during her 14 years at Condé Nast Vogue magazine. She began as her career as executive assistant to the editor-in-chief, you may have heard of her, Anna Wintour, and rose to the role of director of special projects where, among other things, she produced the annual costume institute benefit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, also known as the Met Gala. In four short years, Masonette has become a go-to destination that families and brands alike trust for the quality, convenience, and assortment. I absolutely love this conversation with Silvana. I generally do a lot of research before I bring someone on the podcast. And when I went to Masonette, I don't have kids yet. All of my coolest mom friends followed Masonette, which was how I knew. I'm like, okay, there's something to this. And while looking at the brand, I was like, oh, this is my new go-to for every single children's gift that I ever have to buy. It's just the chicest. I'm absolutely in awe of Silvana's story, her background. There's just so many insights here that you guys are going to absolutely love. Now, let's get on over to my conversation with Silvana.
Welcome to the Woman Inc. podcast. This is the place for the new generation of women looking to lead the life of their absolute dreams. I'm your host, Jenna Toddy, entrepreneur, life coach, and strategist for modern businesswomen and entrepreneurs. I am a city girl, sriracha lover, and that friend who will hype you up when you forget how powerful you truly are. I am on a mission to make Women Inc. the most powerful network of women who are leveling up, owning what they want, and becoming who they've always wanted to be. Have you ever wondered what it would look like if you went all in on yourself, no turning back? If so, you are in the right place, my girl. Let's get started.
Silvana, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. I am honestly so freaking excited to go into your background. Can we start there? Can we rewind? I want to go back to your Vogue days. First, how did you get your job at Vogue? I want to know first that, and then just kind of walk us through like those years of what your career looked like.
Okay. So I guess Vogue was my first job out of school. And I had several internships kind of throughout college, and I wasn't really sure I wanted to go into fashion. I was an English major at Princeton. And so I was like, maybe I want to do journalism. Maybe I want to do more like brand side. And so I had worked at the New York Times Magazine one summer. I worked at Bazaar one summer for Glenda Bailey as her intern, right when she got hired at Bazaar. And then, you know, came out of college and didn't have a job, like no job, was like, you know, living with my boyfriend, like on his floor because my apartment wasn't ready. It was like this like classic, just like post-college experience. And so you sent my resume all over the place. And it was like back in the days where like I faxed my resume. Like, I'm not kidding. I faxed my resume. So I called Condé Nast HR and I was like, hey, like I had sent my email or I had sent my resume. I just want to make sure you got it. And they're like, oh, we didn't get it. Can you fax it again? So I faxed it again. And within like an hour, they called and they're like, oh, there's actually this position, but let's have you just come in for like an informational meeting. So I came in and I was wearing like a very non-fashion sort of business outfit because, you know, I didn't know what I was interviewing for. It was just meant to be HR. I ended up having 11 interviews that day. And my last one was with Anna. And I was like, wait, I'm going to meet with her today. I was like, can I go home and change? Like, this is not going to work. And they're like, no, you're fine. You're fine. And I was like, oh my God, like this is like the worst outfit. And so I went in and I was, I thought for sure I didn't get the job, which is routine for an interview with Anna. There's not a lot of sort of positive feedback, or not even that it's feedback, I should say, feedback in general. I walked out and I was like, there's no way I got that interview or that job. You know, I totally tanked. But then they called me the next day and they said, I got it. And I was, based on what? So I came in and that was that. And then I was there for about 14, 15 years.
That is mad. And did you enjoy it? Like, I feel like that's a job that a lot of people have a lot of feelings about. Did you enjoy your time there?
I loved my time there. I am so, to this day, you know, I talk about it a lot when people ask me about Maisonette and sort of my inspiration and how I got here. And I would say that Vogue was like my business school. And it was, you know, it was like my professor was Anna, and sort of seeing how she navigated like a very male-dominated world in New York City and sort of stood up to anyone and was just kind of this force really motivated me and sort of made me feel confident about sort of my next steps. And so I worked so closely with her for so long, and it was really hard to leave because I felt so safe in that environment. And I felt, you know, like I had, you know, there was more for me to do there, I felt. But ultimately, when I had my babies, I was like, I think it's time for me to do something else. And I want to have a little bit more autonomy, and I want to do something meaningful in my life. And so I kind of decided to start Maisonette on a whim.
Yes, let's jump into Maisonette. So how did the initial idea come to you and your co-founder?
So my co-founder was also Anna's assistant. That's how we met in 2003. She left Vogue after 8 years, and so went and moved down to DC actually with her family. And we had always sort of talked about doing something together. We were obviously very close friends and had babies sort of at the same time. And in 2016, I was about to be pregnant with my third, was ready for my next step, and actually had been working on a lot of kind of what I like to say, kind of like startup-y type things at Condé Nast. It was a time when we were going digital, when Vogue was really trying to find its place in the digital world. Like Vogue.com had just relaunched. We were doing all sorts of things. We had a movie studio. We made a documentary. You know, we were just trying to find ways to monetize our content, because that was not what, you know, historically was the business model. The business model was the print pages and advertising. And this was a very different thing. And so we were sort of charged with finding these new business models, basically. And so we threw a ton of things at the wall. And I got, you know, the luxury of having kind of Anna's sort of stamp of approval of like, go find something from ideation to execution, go do it. And I found that I really loved that process of being like, okay, this is an idea. How do we get it from, you know, A to B to C to D? And I also had to find money for it too. So it was sort of the perfect prep for a startup. And I, you know, was really just complaining to my co-founder one day about how difficult it was for me to find things for my kids. I was like, this is so hard. Why doesn't this exist, right? There's a, you know, online destination that's centralized, that's like a one-stop shop, that's curated for everything else you need in your adult life, right? If you think about like your groceries on Instacart, or anything for your pets on Chewy, or your clothes on Net-a-Porter, you know, like there's a solution for every category in your life that makes it super easy for you to go online and get things you need in that category, and like you're done. But what I found in the kids market was I had 45 web browsers open, right? I was at Zappos for shoes and Serena and Lily for bedding, and, you know, J. Crew for, you know, clothing. There's just so many options. And then on top of that, you had this sort of Instagram explosion of brands, right? And you're, this is so cute and it's so beautiful and it's bohemian and there's a teepee and, you know, it's like the most beautiful rose gold crib, but it's in Australia somewhere. And so I sort of wanted to marry the idea that I needed a place to get things, but I wanted all the special things and all the things that you couldn't find, you know, easily. And so that was what Maisonette really was, is the idea of bringing everything that you need for your kids, that from a curated perspective, we are sort of the barometer of what is value, what is, you know, what is sort of the aesthetic barometer, what is, you know, the fashion barometer, what is the, you know, quality barometer. We sort of define all of those things. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, $5,000 or $5. If it's on our site, it's because we, you know, put our stamp of approval on it. So that was the idea. So just really make it easier for moms like me to find the stuff they need for their kids.
When the email came through for the podcast, I'm looking on Instagram and all of my chicest mom friends follow you. And I was like, okay, no, it's good. I'm like, oh, this is a sign.
I'm very glad to hear that.
So you raised, you raised $50 million. Is that right?
We've actually raised more than that, but yes.
Yeah. And how have you looked at raising money and funding? Like, how has that process been for you?
It's been such a whirlwind and it's changed so much from 2017 to today, which I'm sure you are hearing a lot from women and founders in the space. You know, in the early days, it was like people were excited about new ideas and, you know, particularly marketplaces and e-commerce was just, you know, had this like incredible upswing. And so, you know, we were really lucky to get funded by some incredible VCs. So NEA is our lead VC. Tony Florence is our lead investor. He's behind Goop. He's behind Moda. So many others. They call him sort of the e-commerce whisperer. And he was excited about the idea. And we were really like, great. And so we were off to the races really quickly. And it was kind of a surreal moment where I was really expecting it to be a slog. You hear like these horror stories. And we were so lucky in the beginning, which is not to say that it hasn't been a slog, you know, over the years. I think the funding environment has changed very drastically. So whereas before it was, you know, capital to grow, right? Grow, become that unicorn. Today, you know, given sort of the macro environment, the recessionary environment, you know, inflation, all of these things, post-COVID kind of all of the things, you know, exploding into the perfect storm. This environment is really now about profitability, right? There's not a lot of capital out there for just businesses that are trying to grow and aren't doing so sustainably. And so we made a pivot really, you know, in end of 21, 22 to really focus on profitability and margin. And we're on a great path and sort of close to getting to profitability. And that's incredible. But I think the name of the game right now is just saving your cash and getting it to profitability as quickly as possible.
Yes. Gross margins. Love it. So you're the CEO and then you have your co-founder. What position does she hold?
She's president. So she's really in charge of sort of investor relations internationally. She actually lives in Milan. And so we have actually a very big syndicate of investors from Europe because ultimately we have aspirations of launching internationally. And so we have a really good foothold now of strategic investors over there that she's really managing and has built out once we decide to do that.
And how have you guys separated your roles? Like what are the things that you own and like to do?
You know, it's funny. Early on, I think when you have a co-founder, it's sort of you're doing everything. You're CEO, you're head of HR, you're head of marketing, you're doing all of the things. And so we kind of just tag teamed. You know, I sort of went more marketing and she sort of went more sort of finance. And then we really determined that I would sort of lead the day-to-day business. So I would have all the direct reports and she would be, as I said, kind of more in charge of strategic initiatives, including investors and bringing in sort of big brands, right? I think Lou's superpower is that she has this really extended network, particularly in Europe. And so we've been able to get a lot of these major brands internationally on board because of her, you know, network. And so she's really focused on that. And that's what she likes to do. And I love the sort of the day-to-day. I love being in the weeds with the team, grinding it out, sort of, you know, getting stressed. That's my unique superpower, I guess.
Yeah. Could you walk us through a day in your life? What is a day in the life of a CEO?
Yeah. You know, at first I was not great at balancing. And there are moments I think where I'm not great at it still, but I think I really try to, you know, protect time is what my therapist and I like to say. Because if you don't do that, you'll just be at your computer all day long. You know, so I protect time to take my kids to school in the morning. So we wake up pretty early and like from 6 a.m. till call it 9, I'm with my kids. We're on our sort of like on our way to school. And by 9, I'm walking to the office. So what I love about my life is that my whole life is in like 10 square blocks. I live in Brooklyn. My office is in Brooklyn. My kids go to school in Brooklyn. I walk them to school. I continue walking on into Dumbo. I get another coffee. I'm in the office by like 9:05, 9:10. And then it really is a slew of meetings back to back or Zooms until 5. I mean, it's really just an intense amount of back to back because so much has to get done. And particularly in a remote world, we're a remote first company. You know, you just have more Zooms because you're not in person to sort of just have a quick conversation, you know?
Yeah.
So that's sort of the downside of a remote first business. The upside is obviously you have a lot of freedom to be where you want to be and still work, et cetera. You know, and you know, it's investors, it's team meetings, it's marketing calendar, you know, all of those things. And then by around 5:15, 5:30, I'm on my way home and I protect time for dinner. And I'm sort of back online around 8 after the kids are down to just check if anything else is going on. And then I try to go to bed early. I mean, that for me is my self-care. I, you know, there's a lot of people who do a lot of different things. I don't really work out, which is something I'd like to start to prioritize. I play tennis once a week, once or twice a week. And that's really like a great, like get it all out session twice a week. And I go to bed early. Like those are my times.
Yeah, that's good. I think that the tennis is working out.
It's a workout. I mean, it's a clinic, so it's like a lot of ladies. I need to do something else. If you have any ideas, please let me know.
I just started really getting into working out, but I got a trainer.
What do you do?
That's the key.
That's what everyone says.
She's like, I'm here.
I need somebody to hold me accountable.
Yes.
Yeah.
That changed it for me.
Yeah.
Okay. How big is your team?
We are about 60 onshore and about 30 offshore. So we have a really robust offshore team. And that has been really interesting, actually, because I think there's a lot of, you know, historically you think of offshore as like customer care, but we have really found some incredible talent and it's becoming a much larger market all over the world, actually. And so we have been moving to offshore more and more and sort of reserving kind of more management roles for onshore, and we're all over the country. So I would say a good amount of us are based in the Northeast, but we're sort of scattered all over, but we're about 60 onshore.
It's a big team. How do you manage that? I mean, do you guys have a weekly stand-up daily? Like, how do you keep everyone together?
We do a weekly all hands, which is super helpful. And we try to make it not boring. I mean, I think the problem, you know, is like we go over in business needs and all of those things, but I think we try to bring some levity, some connection, particularly when you're remote. I think it's really important to have these touch, and we're trying to do a better job of that. You know, I think we do a lot of the departments do things on their own, either remotely or in person when they can. But yeah, you have to kind of schedule things in, and it's hard. And the bigger you get, sort of the less connection you have. I mean, when we started, I knew everyone's like mom, you know, it was sort of like a family, and it's great to grow, but I do miss that kind of intimacy you have with kind of the initial team.
Yeah. Now, how many people report to you?
I try not to have more than 5 or 6 direct reports. Right now I have 6, maybe 7.
A good number.
But yeah.
When you are looking at scaling and growing the brand, what is something that you're really focused on in the next year?
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, I think the number one sort of North Star is margin and profitability, right? Is really growing sustainably, finding a way, or finding your way, I should say, of sort of recurring revenue that is scalable, right? So I think what a lot of businesses are seeing is that they're acquiring, you know, certainly in the last 5 years, a lot of these businesses were acquiring customers that were not returning customers, right? So you're spending all this money on Facebook and Meta and Google, and you want to make sure you're getting the right customer in. And so what we're really focused on is kind of marketing efficiency, is really focusing on the right customer, you know, who isn't here for just sort of like a one and done purchase that is, you know, a promo they saw, you know, on the internet, that is someone who, you know, is actually interested in our whole offering and who can be with us from kind of pregnancy through 18 years of age, right? That's really what our focus is on, is really growing with this parent. You know, early days, our sweet spot was sort of 0 to 6. And we've now expanded our assortment because, frankly, my kids have gotten older. And so yeah. I don't need, you know, I don't need a truck and a, you know, a doll anymore. I need outdoor toys and I need, you know, a bike. And my son wears men's size shoes. So what do we do now? You know, so really kind of meeting that customer where they are. And I think what's so the beauty of being a business like ours, it's run by your customer, which is me and Lou, is that you can meet those needs because you're going through it. So the scale is really going to come from growing with this customer, you know, really focus on market efficiencies and getting that customer back. Obviously, repeat is so, so crucial to the sustainability of a business and also sort of investing in the platform, right? And I think the way we think about that is the way we get to scale and still remain curated, right? So if we were to have, so today we have 1,300 brands on site, we could have 10,000 brands on site if we wanted. But right now it's a really manual process. And it's like an account person who is talking to you or going back and forth. There's an Excel template. And so we are investing in automating that process so that can be much more self-service for our vendors. And then once we have all of that stuff on site, right, you want to be able to find it. You don't want to come to site and be overwhelmed. And so that's about investing in AI and personalization. So those are the two kind of more technical areas that we're investing in for scale. And then from sort of a high level perspective, it's about, you know, repeat and margin.
When you talk about acquiring the right customers, the one that you know will return, I'm just personally curious. Sorry if no one else cares about this, but I'm obsessed with e-commerce. How are you able to identify a customer that will have higher lifetime value?
It's all data driven. And I think it's taken us as long as we've been in business, which is now 6 years, to get that data, right? So we look at marketing right now from a SKU perspective, right? And so we know when a customer comes in and you buy, and I'm making this up because I'm not even sure, this is changing daily and we're looking at these numbers, you know, in real time. But when you buy, you know, a pair of leggings, right? A $16 pair of leggings, we know, and again, I'm making this up because I'm not sure that's the actual SKU, that purchase we will see over time is a customer who comes back more and more, right? But if they come in and they buy a puzzle, again, making that up, that person's not coming back. And so what we're actually looking at is kind of on a SKU basis, what SKUs are bringing in the customer we want, right? And so that's all data. That's all years and years of data. And honestly, that's not something we were even able to look at until the last year. Because A, you can collect data, but like then you have to clean it. You've got to make it accessible to your team. I mean, it's a huge undertaking. Yeah. And we're just in the position where we have a data team who can even mine that data and know what to look for when we sort of ask these questions. But so we look at sort of the SKU, we look at the actual channel, right? So we look at obviously ROAS, which is return on ad spend from Google, from social, and then, you know, we can sort of suss out what are our best channels and why, right? Why is search such a great channel? You know, why is shopping such a good channel? And what kind of customer are you getting? So for example, if you're looking at Google shopping, that customer is coming in because they see an actual product. And that is leading them straight to a product page, right? A product listing or a PDP. So they don't even come to our homepage. They don't know what else Maisonette is offering, right? In their minds, if you've never heard of Maisonette and you saw a dress and you're coming right to the PDP, you're, oh, here's a dress. But you're not going to the homepage. You're not seeing like, oh, they actually carry toys and decor and, you know, everyday necessities. And so that is typically not a lifetime value customer. You want a customer who's coming in sort of higher funnel, who's kind of looking and browsing and sort of understanding the value prop that we offer. Maybe doesn't purchase the first time, but comes back when they need something. And they're like, oh, I remember that thing that has those things. And then that customer is bought in, you know. So it's a balance and it's super nuanced. And I would say that right now in this environment, with Meta being as expensive as it is to advertise and all of them, people are really moving away from paid marketing and really leaning into first party data and really, sort of depending on their own data to inform the things that they're either assorting their assortment on, so expanding assortment on, or sending their emails about, or whatever that may be. And that's really converting more than paid channels right now, in my experience.
Current commerce, yeah. Ugh, I love this. I could talk to you about this forever.
I know, we can geek out.
Yeah, we could geek out. How have you been able to create a culture at Maisonette that you're proud of?
I think that is a work in progress. I think it is so hard to do that. It's one of the things I'm really focused on. It's hard. You know, you're never going to please everyone. And I am such a people pleaser. And I care so much about these things. And I take so many things personally. And everyone's like, don't take it personally. It's going to be okay. And I'm like, but she hates me. But, you know, I think there's a few things that I think go a long way. I think transparency goes a long way. You know, like, don't hide anything, I would say. And obviously there are things, it's sort of like a need to know and a good to know and a nice to know. There are things that you also don't like that an assistant or a junior level, I see if they heard like things about runway or things about investors, they might get afraid, right? And in out of context, it can be scary. But things like, hey, this macro environment's hard and it's not that easy to fundraise right now. And so this is why we're making all these changes. And this is why we're, you know, thinking about assortment in a different way. And because otherwise you're asking them to do things that they have no context for and they don't believe in. And so really giving them as much transparency as you can, right? I think is important. And being authentic. You know, I'm an incredibly authentic person. I cuss all the time on all hands. I probably shouldn't, but I am who I am. And, you know, I think people appreciate that I'm not, you know, I don't read from a script. You know, I really want to be, you know, transparent and authentic with my team because that's, I think, the right thing to do. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of other CEOs who probably are far more buttoned up and far more, maybe professional is the word, maybe formal is the word. But for me, I think our team, for the most part, likes working for us because it's, you know, it's kind of a, you have a voice. We're listening to you. Some things are really hard to hear, but we're going to tell you them anyway. And I think, so there's like that. And I think the other piece is listening. Like I said, like, I think really listening to your team. We do so many surveys. We talk to them about so many things. We will, you know, like we do round tables. You always want to be sort of have your finger on the pulse, right? Because the second it gets away, it snowballs. So that's what I would say. That's at 60 people. I may have a different perspective when we're at 100 and 120 and beyond, hopefully. But right now it's really important.
No, I think that's actually amazing advice and so important. I'm the same.
Yeah.
But it creates that like truly like unbreakable bond because they're fighting for you. I also think they know how we're working. So they're like, oh, she's not asking me to do this and not in the trenches with us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's big.
I agree.
What are you most excited about in the future of Maisonette? Why it's going international?
I'm excited about this space. I think it's been an underserved category. I think if you think about the kids space and the parenting space, it's sort of, you know, like the big brands that have kind of dominated the space are very legacy brands. It's sort of like the Children's Place, or it was Toys R Us and Babies R Us, you know, Carter's. You know, there hasn't really been a massive brand that has taken my meaningful mind share of this customer in a really long time. And I think that's because this customer has evolved. You know, it's a millennial parent who has so much to think about and is so overwhelmed by choice now. You know, like when my parents were raising me, there was like one crib, one stroller, like there was no optionality. Like it was like one store down the street. People care now about, you know, the organic materials, sort of how your high chair looks in your West Elm apartment, how, you know, your kids are such a piece of your brand, such a piece of your family. They're not hidden. You know, kids used to be like, you know, seen and not heard. It was very different culturally. Today, it's an incredibly nuanced purchase funnel. And not a lot of brands are able to speak to this parent. And so our focus has really been about talking to this parent about things that are relevant, offering them the things that they need and telling them why these things are better than the other thing. I think it's growing super fast and we're just scratching the surface. You know, I feel like this industry has really only existed at this level for the last 15 years. I think Bugaboo was the first luxury stroller and it came out in like 1996. Like it's a young category. And I think we were really lucky to get in early. And I think we will, or I should say aim to be kind of the brand that matters in this space, right? The brand that sort of families turn to. And that when you think about family and you think about kids and parenting, you think about Maisonette. And I think there's so much more to do. I think it's so exciting, you know, the way that how quickly this space is growing. And I can't wait for kind of our next big moments. And there's a lot on the pipeline that I can't share, but I think there's, you know, as we like to say in all hands, world domination. Yeah. Yeah. But that's sort of the aim.
That's so exciting. I don't have kids yet, but I can't wait to come shop.
I can't wait till you do.
Yeah. Thank you. Lavanya, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I have one more question for you, is what would be your number one piece of advice for a woman who's wanting to start her own business?
Oh my God. I would do so many things differently and nothing differently, because I think about all the things I would do differently. And then I think about how much I've grown and how much I've learned. And it was so important for me to fail at so many things in this process in order to learn those things. And so I think it's really important to fail a little bit and to try things, and they're not going to work. They're not all going to work, and it's not going to be easy. And anyone who tells you it's easy is wrong, but you have to keep going, because really when startups fail, it's because the founders get tired, you know? Money's part of it, right? But like, it's really, you lose the will. And so if you really believe in something, you just have to keep picking yourself back up and saying, okay, we're gonna try this again. And you will persevere. I promise, as long as you have the will and you don't give up, it will happen. You just need the will.
Good. I'm motivated. I'm ready to like, give me some.
Look, I need to tell myself this sometimes. I'm like, I need a will. I have the will. Yeah.
No, it's so true. I think that's so true. Yes. Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much. It was so lovely.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be on this. When my team told me, I was like, really?